Now, back to Vocal Point with your host, Jerry Newcomb, on GraceNetRadio.com.
And welcome back. We're talking right now with Dana Gioia, and he wrote a piece for First Things magazine. First Things magazine is a very intellectual and thoughtful Christian publication, primarily Catholic, I guess, but it appeals to all Christians. And this piece deals with the issue of the decline of Christian influence when it comes to literature. And Dana Gioia actually used to run the National Endowment for the Arts from 2003 to 2009. Now, the National Endowment for the Arts, you may recall, about 25 years ago, they were pretty controversial because they were supporting things in the name of art that were actually insulting to people's faith. I remember talking about the one object, Andre Serrano, you know, urinated in a jar and put a crucifix in it, took a photograph of it, and got thousands of dollars from the government, and that was so-called art. And Dana took over that agency and helped steered away from those kinds of things and get into Shakespeare in the American City and Poetry Out Loud and other positive things towards art. Dana, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right. Hey, thank you, by the way, for your role in helping to essentially keep the National Endowment for the Arts out of the headlines because of controversy.
Well,
Andre Serrano.
We brought it back into good headlines.
Yeah, okay, good. All right. That's a good way.
The trick wasn't doing nothing. It was doing good things.
Sure. All right. Now, I've got the article that you wrote in firstthings.com. I guess it was from December 2013. And I've got a portion of it that I want to quote a little bit here, and then you can comment on some of this, okay?
Please.
The collapse of Catholic literary life reflects a larger crisis of confidence in the church that touches on all aspects of religious, cultural, and intellectual life. What I have said so far also pertains, in general terms, to all American Christians. Whatever their denomination, they have increasingly disengaged themselves from artistic culture. They have, in effect, ceded, that's C-E-D-E-D, the arts to secular society. Needless to say, for Catholicism, this cultural retreat, indeed this virtual surrender, represents a radical departure from the church's traditional role as patron and mentor to the arts. In only 50 years, the patron has become the pariah. Can you comment on this? This is a fascinating point.
Well, you know, the main point of my article is that if you look at the arts in America today, you see virtually no positive representation of Catholics or, you know, for the most part, Christians.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is an entirely secular enterprise. And in fact, much of it is anti-Christian, is anti-Catholic. I think it's odd that, and I'll talk strictly about Catholics first, then we can talk about broader Christians.
Sure.
That it seems to me odd that the largest religious group in the United States, Catholics, which is one quarter of the population, which is also the largest cultural group in the country, is invisible in our culture, except in a sense to be attacked. You know, and so what my essay does is explore, you know, why that happened and what the consequences of it are. Now, I talk mostly about literature because mm-hmm. it matters the stories that we tell in society, the books we read, the films we see, the songs we hear, the poems we read. Those stories give us versions of reality. And if the Christian worldview, the Catholic worldview, is entirely absent in the art that a society produces, I think some things go very wrong.
Hmm. All right. Well, let me quote you some more. And by the way, I will say this. If you were to lump all evangelicals together from different denominations, that would obviously be a larger subgroup, I think.
I mean, depending on how you count it, I mean, you know, Christians are about, you know, 70% of the U.S. population. I mean, you know, more. I mean, it depends on what you call church. But I'm a Catholic, and the Catholic situation is very odd. because, you know, 100 years ago, this was a Protestant, or, you know, 120 years ago, this was a Protestant country.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much all the art, all the writing was Protestant. So the funny thing is that the Protestants have fallen farther than the Catholics in terms of being kicked out of culture, kicked out of the arts. You know, Catholicism didn't really become present in literature until around World War II. So, we had one brief shining moment. but I figured that, you know, if I was writing about the Protestants, I'd have to write about very different historical, sociological, even theological notions. But like it or not, Catholics and Protestants are in the same boat on this issue.
I agree.
I think they've got to think together and work together.
Yeah, I agree with you. Now, here's another part of your article. You say, the schism between Christianity and the arts has had two profound consequences, two vast impoverishments, one for the arts world, the other for the church. First, for the arts world, the loss of a transcendent religious vision, a refined and rigorous sense of the sacred, the breaking and discarding of 2,000 years of Christian mythos, symbolism, and tradition has left contemporary American art spiritually diminished. The shallow novelty, the low-cost nihilism, and the vague and sentimental spiritual pretensions of so much contemporary art in every medium are the legacy of this schism, as well as the cynicism that pervades the art world. So go ahead and comment on that, what you wrote.
Well, let me say something. I've never seen anybody talk about what I'm about to say, but I think it's absolutely true. If you look at atheists, if you look at secular atheists, now, I don't blame them for doing what they're doing. I mean, if they believe that, then, ironically, God bless them. Let them do what they believe. it's the Christians that really need to react. But what the atheists believe is that if they can just get rid of God, if they can just get rid of Christianity, take these terrible superstitions and destroy them, that humanity will suddenly rise and think in terms of scientific rationalism. You'll have, once again, ironically, heaven on earth. Now, atheists think that they're very rational and very smart, but that has to be the stupidest vision I've ever heard of in my life. Because if you take religion out of people's lives, if you take God, if you take the supernatural out of their lives, they don't replace it with reason and science and goodness. The spiritual hungers remain, and people satisfy them in far worse ways. I mean, they begin, doing voodoo, horoscopes, New Age, et cetera, et cetera. They jump on every bandwagon because they do not have the discipline of the great Christian vision. And so what happens is you take nourishing spiritual food around from them, and you put in junk food, Wiccans, Santeria, things like this. And I think we see this in our society. The loss of influence of the church has actually made our society more violent, more vulgar, more irrational.
By the way, you said in that quote that I had, there were two problems, and the first one was for the arts world itself. Then what's the other one you want to say?
Okay, well, if you think the atheists are silly, you got to look at the Christians, too. Because there is a temptation among Christians, and at the risk of offending your listeners, I think it's a bigger temptation for Protestants. Catholics, have this more recently, is that if you fear art, if you fear painting and sculpture and storytelling, and music and drama and things like this, these ways essentially that we speak, in art, you lose one of the ways in which, people communicate. I mean, the average person does not think rationally. They think holistically. God gave them a body and a soul, and they experience the world every moment in the fullness of their humanity. As a thinking creature, a feeling creature, breathing with their body, their soul, their memory, their imagination, their emotions, their intuition. What art does is speak to that simultaneously and not ask you to divide it. You know, that's why theology is really great for theologians. But people do not come to change core beliefs usually through reason. It's experiential. They experience the greatness of God. They experience grace. And then afterwards, they go to the theology to figure out, why did this happen? So they can explain it to themselves, they can explain it to their friends. And so when the church loses the power of art, it loses one of the primary ways in which God has his message heard in the world. Now, if you don't believe me, if you've got somebody out there that says, that's wrong, that's been so, you know, let's look at Jesus. When Jesus preached to the multitudes, he didn't talk theological categories. He told stories. He gave maxims. He recited poems like the Beatitudes because he understood the parables, the poems, were the way in which the average person experiences and understands the world.
Well, that's true. And when you think about even... this is my body, which is broken for you. Take and eat of it all, you. This is my blood. You know, in the early church, they were accused by some of the Roman neighbors and so forth as if they were engaged in secret cannibalism and drinking blood and things like this. And it wasn't that. But Jesus was reaching all of their senses with his gospel message. It's interesting.
Well, exactly.
Go ahead.
You know, there's an old British anti-Catholic expression that actually was quoted on Downton Abbey last season, where the guy says, Catholicism, you know, bells and incense. But the fact is, you know, if you go to the Mass, you know, you experience all five senses, you know, especially when you taste, you know, and consume the Eucharist. You see it, you hear it, you smell it, you taste it, you touch it. And that's not primitive. It's sophisticated. It says that God gave us, you know, five senses. Is it somehow possible that one of them is not worthy of God? Mm. He made a mistake. You know, we're not supposed to experience the sacred with, you know, with the totality of our humanity. And that's the power of art. Art addresses us as incarnate humans. We're not disembodied spirits. Yeah. I mean, it would be easier, perhaps, if we were, but we aren't.
Well, that's a good point. And in fact, Martin Luther once said that he said that when you think about it, God is a spirit, but if you're only talking about the body, you know, the devil is a spirit, but God in Jesus became a human being. So he had a body. So, I mean, there is a sense, and there is, by the way, I've got to say that when you look at some of the great music in the church and so forth, both Catholic and Protestant, I mean, Bach was a devout Lutheran, for example. But, I mean, you're looking at hearing some of the greatest music ever produced. When you look at beautiful cathedrals, you're looking at some of the finest buildings ever built in the world. And it does, like you say, it appeals to all the different senses. And it just shows you the majesty and the glory of God. Now, unfortunately, a lot of those buildings today, you're not going to hear the right message because they've lost it. The people inside have lost it. Just like, you know, in the French Revolution,
but
you know.
It makes, if you imagine being in the Middle Ages and coming into a city, the most important and magnificent building in the city was the cathedral.
Right, that's true.
That makes a statement without any words.
Right.
About the importance of God, the importance of faith. You know, if you come into a city nowadays, you'd probably be hard pressed to find a church.
Mm-hmm.
The most important buildings, you know, are the government, are the corporate headquarters, are the shopping malls. And you know, the power of architecture, of art, of music, of literature. And so, you know, what I'm focusing on in the piece is about writing. I mean, if you go back right after World War II, and you know, the most important writers in America, a substantial number of them, were Catholic. Some of them were converts. Ernest Hemingway was a convert. Tennessee Williams was a convert. The great poet Wallace Stevens converted on his deathbed. Some of them were, you know, basically lifelong, Catholics. Jack Kerouac, Flannery O'Connor, Catherine Ann Porter became, you know, an early convert. Thomas Merton. These are people who essentially, even if you weren't a Christian, you could not ignore their importance in American literature. You know, now you almost never hear the voice of faith in American literature. You've got a couple of people. You have one great Protestant novelist, Marilyn Robinson, a Calvinist. And she's truly a great novelist. You've got a couple of Catholics, Alice McDermott, Tobias Wolff, Ron Hansen, but this is a tiny group compared to the dozens and dozens of important people that were practicing in mid-century. We need to have our voice heard in society at every level. I mean, it's as important to have Christians in literature as it is in Congress.
Mm. That's a great, great point. We're talking right now with Dana Gioia. And he was the director of the National Endowment for the Arts 2003 to 2009. So I assume that President George W. Bush was the one who appointed you to such a position. And
yeah.
He's written a great article at firstthings.com, and it's all about the importance between Christianity and literature. I'm going to go ahead and quote more from your article, all right, and then have you just comment on it further. If you dislike Christianity, I'm quoting you, if you dislike Christianity, which some readers of this essay surely do, you may regard the decline of Catholic literature as a sign of progress. It seems proof positive that contemporary Christianity lacks creativity and cultural intelligence. But even in secular terms, this position is myopic and self-defeating, not to mention undemocratic. The retreat of the nation's largest cultural minority from literary discourse does not make art healthier. Instead, it weakens the dialectic of cultural development. It makes American literature less diverse, less vital, and less representative. Your comment.
Well, I think it's true. I mean, you know, if you go to some universities nowadays, you know, you have people all of the same political stripe, same ideological stripe, the same anti, Christian stripe, talking to each other, and they think that they're geniuses, you know, because they all agree with each other. I think they would be smarter. They would be smarter as atheists, you know, if they actually had a smart Christian or Catholic arguing with them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a kind of you know, it's interesting. Like, if you take a area of the country and you only plant one crop in it, like tobacco, you know, or something like this, you know, what happens is that it exhausts the soil, and and eventually, ruins the entire farming trade, because, you know, people lose, you know, all of the edge they do in terms of understanding how nature and agriculture interact. That's what's happening in our universities, I think, to a very great degree. It's what's happening in our intellectual life, especially in New York City. Diversity, in the real sense, not in the watered-down sense it's used in PC circles, but diversity, which is to say you respect the individuality, you respect the beliefs, you respect the dignity of people, makes a society a little more rambunctious, but a lot smarter and a lot more vital.
Well, that's so true. In fact, speaking of diversity, in the Bible itself, you see a picture up, when John, had the apocalypse and everything, and it's a strange, writing. But listen to this. I'm just going to quote from Revelation chapter 7, verse 9, the Apostle John. Quote, after this I saw a vast crowd, too great to count, from every nation and tribe and people and language, standing in front of the throne and before the Lamb. They were clothed in white and held palm branches in their hands. And they were shouting with a mighty shout, salvation comes from our God on the throne and from the Lamb. Now, notice the diversity there. They were from every nation, every tribe, every people, and every language. I mean, that's true diversity.
Well, it is. I mean, if you look at the Nicene Creed, and pretty much all Christians except the Nicene Creed. There's a line that Protestants flinch at, but it's properly understood as actually very Protestant. They go I believe in one Catholic, holy and apostolic church, but it's small c Catholic.
Right, universal.
It says that the message of Christ is universal to all mankind.
Right.
And actually, Christianity in its proper form is an essentially, necessarily diverse enterprise, because you're trying to take people from all over the world, every class, every culture, every language, and bring them to Christ.
Hmm.
If you aren't, I mean, my wife, you know, who's not Catholic, she's a Presbyterian, you know, although probably far holier than me, is, you know, we're talking about this. And I said, well, you know, the Catholic Church is probably the greatest mechanism for handling diversity that's ever existed, because for 2,000 years it's had to handle all these people, you know, from all these different countries, you know, and it, you know, and it shows that this can, you know, be done through God.
Hmm.
What strikes me is, and I say this with bitter irony, that the people who champion diversity in our culture often discriminate overtly against Christianity. There's a
very true.
There's a Catholic high school in Sonoma County where I live, which is kind of, you know, gradually become a kind of rich kids school. It's still supposed to be Catholic, and they had no priests, no nuns at all there, and they finally brought a nun there who began teaching a theology class. And some of the faculty complained that in a Catholic high school, it was against diversity to have a class in theology, because it made it seem like Christians were better than other people, you know. And God bless this tough nun, and she put them in their place. But you know, the fact that it's not diverse for Christians to explain their own beliefs and heritage, duh.
Yeah, that's very true. In fact, there was a study that was reported in World Magazine about 4 years ago or whatever. They set out to see how widespread anti-Semitism was among college professors, and they found, thankfully, it was a very small percentage. But they did find also, they found that 53% of college professors have a bias and discrimination against evangelicals, but think that it's right to be biased and discriminating against evangelicals. It's like, what? You know, anyway. But I know your article focuses on literature, but let me step back and talk for just a moment about the arts in general, and specifically music. Because during the time, let's say in epochs of where there was more faith, there was a lot greater output of great music. Let's just take the example of classical music. By the time you get to the early 20th century and we start moving away from the Christian faith being held at large and, let's say, among the Western elites, okay, then all of a sudden the music starts to become dissonant, and it gets away from the notes and so forth that Johann Sebastian, the scales or whatever, the Bach helped, solidify or whatever. And then really when it's all said and done, if you go to a symphony orchestra today, a symphony performance, chances are you're going to hear something that was written in the 1800s or the 1700s or the 1600s. You're not going to hear much that was written in the 1900s. Maybe you'll hear Rachmaninoff, but Rachmaninoff was in effect a 20th century composer. I'm sorry, a 19th century composer.
No, he was 20th.
Yeah, I know, but he happened to live in the 20th century, but he was a 19th century composer, is my point.
Yeah, I agree with you up to a point.
Okay.
I think what happened is that early in the 20th century, mostly German, intellectual composers, you know, decided that they were going to invent, you know, a system of music that was better than the old system. And they created 12-tone music and atonal music. And they pretty much convinced most professors of music all over the world that this was the new style. The problem is, 100 years later, nobody still likes this stuff.
Right.
However, some of the most popular music in the world is 20th century music.
Mm.
Giacomo Puccini, Sergei Rachmaninoff, people like this, and now those people tend to be mocked, by the musical intellectuals, but that is the music Ralph Vaughan Williams, Edward Elgar, people like that people still listen to with pleasure voluntarily.
Right.
The arts in general became increasingly alienated from, the experience and the sensibility of average people. That's why I think that I'm a poet, as you know, that one of the things I think that the 21st century artist must do is to reconcile, itself with the past, mm-hmm. to reconnect with those things in the past which, gave art its power and its appeal. There's a lot you can learn from the 20th century, a kind of intensity, a kind of an innovation. But once you lose the audience, art is a diminished thing.
Well, let's take an example. Here's a specific example of unbelief at work. During the days of the Soviet Union, didn't they have movies that they made? Didn't they have plays that were produced? Didn't they have books that came out? And they were all kind of in praise of the Soviet ideal and all that stuff. How many of us read any of that stuff or watch those movies or listen to that music?
Well, but the Soviets understood that they needed art. The Soviets understood that they could communicate, they could sugarcoat some messages, better with art. And there's a few. I mean, Alexander Nevsky by Prokofiev and Eisenstein, one of the great films of the 20th century, is essentially a anti-German, pro-Stalinist film, but they put it in the Middle Ages and they give it a great musical score. And so, it works as long as you don't think about it, too much. But I think what you're talking about is that art in some ways has lost its way because it's become disconnected on the one hand from the average person
and the creator,
on the other hand from truth.
Yeah. And also the creator. I mean,
yeah,
well, especially when it's anti-God.
That's truth.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. One of the great composers of the 20th century, a modernist, is Igor Stravinsky. But Stravinsky was a Christian; he was a believer, and you see this, in a thing like Symphony of the Psalms and some of the religious music and the ballets that he had, it kept him grounded, in a way I think that some of the other composers, were not, but the Protestants have taken much better care of music than the Catholics. The music in the Catholic Church is, for the most part, appalling. It's worse than amateur hour. And so this, as a Catholic, I lust after the Lutheran hymnal, which is such a great, a great collection of sacred music. But let me tell you that there are a couple of truly, truly great composers alive right now. These are classical composers. One of which his name is Morten Lauridsen, Lauridsen. Almost anybody who's singing in a serious choir in your audience has probably sung the music of Morten Lauridsen, O Magnum Mysterium, Lux Aeterna. And he is a spiritually profound composer that I think you could hold up against Mozart.
Wow.
And he doesn't suffer by comparison. The interesting thing is he's become one of the most widely performed composers maybe the most widely performed composer in America. But the New York critics never mention him because most of his music is sacred music.
Oh. Yeah, but it's interesting. There's a song called Pia Jesu by Andrew Lloyd Webber, and they sang it recently in our church. It was just absolutely fantastically done. And I was thinking, if the Lord tarries, and let's say we're still around 200 years from now, people are still going to be singing Pia Jesu, but they might not be performing The Lion King that he also wrote, or Jesus Christ Superstar, or the Phantom of the Opera, whatever. So anyway, bottom line is, Christianity and the arts, there's a great need for Christians to get involved in art and producing quality art again. That's the bottom line thesis. And you focus on literature, but that's your bottom line. Do you want to have a concluding thought for us?
No. Christians are always complaining about the culture. and how it's corrupting things. But you might as well continue to complain, because unless you do something, it won't change. It's time for Christians to regain their rightful place in the arts and culture.
Excellent point. And on that, we'll close. Firstthings.com for more information. Again, our guest has been Dana Gioia. Gioia is spelled how? The last name?
It's Italian. G-I-O-I-A. There's no J in Italian, so the G-I is a J in Italian.
Okay. Hey, thank you so much for being with us. I enjoyed it.
It's a great pleasure.
All
Good
right.
Luck.
All the best to you. You too. Thank you, Dana Gioia. Again, that man was the director of the National Endowment for the Arts from 2003 to 2009. And as he just said in summary, there's a great need for Christians to get more involved in the arts. Well, this is Jerry Newcomb. Have a great week. We'll see you next week. God bless you on GraceNetRadio.com.
Thank you for listening to Vocal Point. The views and opinions were those of the host, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of GraceNetRadio.com or any of its staff, management, or affiliations. Join us next Thursday at noon for Vocal Point on GraceNetRadio.com.